This is the BBC.
Thank you for downloading this edition of the Westminster Hour with Carolyn Quinn. You can find more information about the programme on the BBC website. Who cares about the new Bake Off panel when you meet the tasty combination we have for you tonight on the Westminster Hour? Claire Perry, Conservative MP for Devizes and a former Rail Minister. She resigned after David Cameron quit as Prime Minister, reportedly in frustration over the seemingly intractable Southern Rail dispute. You said you felt ashamed at the problems caused to commuters, didn't you?
I did.
Labour's Frank Field here as well has represented Birkenhead since 1979, chairman of the Work and Pensions Committee now, and he's been the scourge of the former BHS boss, Sir Philip Green. He was among the small minority of Labour MPs who argued for the UK to leave the EU. Welcome to you. And welcome too to the businessman, Stephen Hester, who's chief executive of RSA. That's one of the world's leading multinational insurance groups. You may remember him as the former CEO of the Royal Bank of Scotland, brought in, of course, under the Labour government to help turn it round after it teetered on the brink of collapse during the financial crisis of 2008. And Stephen and Claire, you know the man of the moment, George Osborne. We heard about him in the news there. Stephen, you crossed swords, of course, with him at RBS. You disagreed over the bank's direction. He won the argument and you were out. And Claire, you worked with him before you became an MP in 2010 and remained close to him in government. So, I mean, do you think he can reconcile being a backbench MP with, hang on, having a constituency nearly 200 miles away, editing a daily newspaper, advising an investment company and travelling the world, making corporate speeches? I might have missed a job or two, but do you think? I do.
I think it's absolutely amazing. I mean, George is still young in political terms. He's incredibly talented. He has lots to offer various governments going forward. And I think it's actually incredibly interesting. And I think it will be a fascinating thing, because one of the problems we've had in the whole Brexit debate is anyone who raises sort of reasonable questions about, well, what does the shape of this deal look like, gets howled down a bit in the media. So actually having him at the helm of a very successful daily, I think, could be very, very interesting for the debate.
Can he really work as well as he should for his constituents?
Well, so it's interesting because, of course, when you're a minister, and Frank will know this from his time, that's like having a second full-time job. And the proof of the pudding is, do your constituents think you are doing the right thing for them and supporting them? We know his constituency chairman has said that's perfectly fine. We'll know at the next election what the people he represents think of that. But yes, I think it is possible. And he's made it quite clear, he's made it very transparent, all the things he's doing. Remember, Parliament also sits for certain times of the year, and then there are long recesses when MPs typically travel or go and do their constituency business. So I think he will make a really good fist of fitting it all in.
Well, Stephen Hester, you've had experience in city trading, in banking, insurance now. Do you think he can handle this vast portfolio of jobs he's taken on?
Well, it seems to me there are two different issues. I mean, he's a very clever and talented man, and I think it'll be interesting to see how he does, to see if he can make more of it than a publicity stunt. And I think that'll be fun and good for all of us too, as readers. I think there's a completely different issue, though, which is, should you combine a full-time job as a politician with a full-time job as a newspaper editor, in addition to non-executive roles, which he's got? And it seems to me, certainly in the world of business that I come from, my shareholders would have a revolt, and I would have to step down immediately if I were to take another full-time job. I think that it is very hard to combine those things.
So non-exec role would be all right, would it?
Yeah, I think that's right. Part-time roles, they may be not-for-profit, they may be all different kinds, but it's well acknowledged that people can do more than one thing. But I think particularly when you're in the business of public trust, whether that's the trust of your shareholders in the case of business or politicians, I do think that that's a step too far.
The Standard, of course, is a paper that reports on the city and on business. So, Stephen, he's going to be advising the investment company BlackRock 4 days a month and being paid £650,000 for it. How much of a conflict of interest might that pose?
I am not so troubled by that. I think if you declare your roles, if you have non-executive roles, and if you're not a minister, then you can deal with these sorts of things. I think the issue is more, I mean, there may be some lack of wisdom from a political standpoint in if you like, following in the perhaps the Tony Blair footsteps, but I think there's no conflict that I would worry about. The standard, I think, is a different thing given its time commitment.
Frank Field, he didn't get approval from the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments, and they're supposed to clear appointments like this, aren't they? And the Standards in Public Life Committee is now going to investigate the whole issue of MPs having second jobs. What do you make of it all?
I think his friends should give him a health warning. I think it's impossible to actually do these as a combined job and do them properly. And I think on the question you put to Stephen about whether there was going to be sort of a conflict of interest, to prove a conflict of interest, you'd have to prove he knew what was going on. But it assumes that his advice to BlackRock, he knew about what was going into his paper, given the amount of effort it must take to edit a paper of that that intensity. So one wishes him luck. But we do have to remember, of course, his seat disappears at reboundaries. And we may have rebounders if we don't have an early election. And maybe he does genuinely believe the role of being a city mayor is a great role to have, and that he wants the Standard as a base from which he can be the Tory candidate against the present Sadiq, the present incumbent.
Well, it might be that, but Claire Perry, you touched on something, this idea of it perhaps being a way of pushing the Remain case, but from outside government. There are a lot of people talking now about divisions within the Tory party and this Standard job perhaps being a platform to push the Remain message after he's been moved out.
But I think we need to be careful that, you know, Remain is not, the Remain case is not what Tony Blair and Nick Clegg were saying.
Brexit,
yes,
then.
The sort of sensible Brexit that puts facts and figures ahead of ideology, and which George has argued for. But I just wanted to make one thing. I mean, he was Chancellor during a really rather torrid time for the British economy, and politically a torrid time in a coalition government, which required a lot more kind of, you know, business behind the scenes to get things done, as well as being a really good MP for Tatton. So I go back to the fact that I think it is possible to do both jobs. And yes, I think that what he will hope to do is to provide another voice for people who, you know, are focused on the economy and focused on getting the best economic deal for Britain out of the negotiations.
Because John Major has accused ultra-Brexiteers in the government of low-grade personal abuse, seeking to silence anyone who holds an opposing view to the EU debate.
I mean,
you talked about some of your colleagues being like jihadis.
Well, which I then amended to Brexit fundamentalists, having been appraised of the damage jihadis do. And this is a very, very small number of colleagues, but for whom no Brexit is hard enough. And I think the country actually rejects that. I mean, if you ask
people... Do you think that Frank... don't view him like... But you want a hard Brexit, presumably.
No,
do
I don't. I think as we move forward, the politics is much more complicated than many of us thought at the time. My predecessor was Edmund Dell, wonderful Trade Secretary, and he gave me two pieces of advice. One was... Have your cake and eat it. And I think one of the things we really do need to do is to argue for access to the free market. I do not think that should be ruled out. The idea that there will be tariffs between us and Europe, the chaos, even if we could actually work it out and even if we had the machinery to levy them, you know what we all know what the French will be like. There won't be a lorry moving one way or the other.
This idea of chaos and confusion. We heard Tony Blair on the Andrew Marr programme this morning saying that Labour should be prepared to offer voters the chance of staying in the European Union if the government fails to secure its promised trade deal with the remaining member states. He pointed to the complexity of the task ahead. Here he is.
I didn't understand how complicated this is going to be. I mean, if they're going to try and deliver exactly the same benefits as we have now in the single market and customs union, this is an endeavour of unparalleled complexity. And what people explain to me is that normally in trade negotiations, you're talking about how you liberalise trade, right? This is about how you deliberalise over 40 years of complex trading arrangements. Now, I think... when the only thing people can point to is you're going to control a section of this EU immigration as the reason why we want to do this, I think it's possible, I don't put it higher than that, people start to think Is this really going to be the thing that is going to be important?
So Frank Field, Tony Blair talking about the complexity of working on this. And there are warnings, aren't there, that up to 15 new bills might be needed in addition to the Great Repeal Bill to deliver Brexit. Are you recognising what Tony Blair and others say about the complexity ahead?
Well, we've got to do something with our time, so 15 bills on this won't be much different from 15 bills on something else. I think the key thing is, Caroline, as time goes on, it's quite clear that this huge negotiation, the most important event for us since the Second World War, cannot be done in neat little timetables.
So 2 years, you can't do it in 2 years.
Just like with the voters in America with President Trump, he said he was going to build a wall. They all knew he wasn't going to build a wall, but he would actually try and do something about immigration. And I think that's where the British people are. They also know that we cannot do it overnight, that we would actually have serious consequences on the economy, that we need to sort of reshape our educational system and many other things so that we have got a skilled labour force.
So, Frank, are you saying that there will have to be some sort of transitional deal, that there is no way that this can be sorted out by 2020, say?
That won't be in our gift. That will be in the gift of the other members. But I would hope we could create an atmosphere in which that they didn't think that an alarmist thing to do. While we are going to leave, clearly they are going to have to punish us because this alliance is kept together by people who fear other people who are actually going to follow us. And I think part of that will be the contribution that we make. And I think the simple way...
Well, the financial contribution.
The financial contribution is that clearly we ought to keep free trade with the European Union. And in return, we make a contribution for the levies that they would put on
us. How much? 40?
No, nothing. I think nothing like that. But and whoever's doing the negotiation doesn't want to actually start talking about figures. But we do need to recognise lovely old Tony Blair popping up like this, talking about how complicated it's been. And in other words, look at me, I'm here ready to serve. That's all it's all about. It's a PR job. It's a PR job for him.
He may not be the only one.
But also to realise that sometimes complicated matters can be met by standard payments in lieu of tariffs, which would be far less than what you would just suggest.
Let me bring in Stephen at this point, if I may, because your sector, the insurance sector, the banking sector, the financial sector, is working out how to deal with this. Are you now reconciled to the idea of being out of the single market? And how then is your sector preparing for what's to come?
Well, as you say, it's a very big sector in absolute terms and for the British economy. And I think it would be wrong to say that there's a unified view. But overwhelmingly, the city has prospered over hundreds of years by being, in some respects, an international free trading, free flow of goods, services, capital, people. I think it's clear that Brexit is likely to be negative, both economically and culturally. But I think it's also clear that the city has withstood negative events in the past. And so I believe that we will come out to the end of this with some adjustment, with some individual businesses and business lines that have had a worse time than others. But overall, with the city still being a major part of the British economy and generally successful. And so people are assuming Brexit will go ahead. They're assuming that the logic of the negotiating positions will lead you to perhaps a face-saving version of a hard Brexit, but nevertheless ultimately a hardish Brexit.
What would that look like then?
Well, I think that it is likely that the single market will be out, that there will be some obstacles to trade, there'll be some barriers, there'll be some bureaucratic barriers as well as some financial barriers, and there'll be some retaliative-for-tat type moves, whether that be around people's access and queues and customs or whether that be around licences or euro clearing or whatever. So I'm very clear, obviously, as a Remainer, that this is not the greatest decision that we will have made. But nevertheless, I don't think it'll be disaster. I think the city will be ingenious, will find its way around.
Will you have to move staff to other EU countries?
There will
because
be
there was
some,
a lot of talk of that, wasn't there?
There will be some negative economic consequences, which means less taxes and less people. But I say some. I don't believe this is going to be a disaster. I think this will be just a less good option, but not in any way a terrible option.
And in terms of the way that the City of London, the financial centre, operates, there's been talk about passporting arrangements which allow UK-based financial institutions to operate across Europe. That's not going to happen now, is it? We're moving towards a concept of equivalence, which would allow UK banks to continue trading in Europe, but with less security. Would you be satisfied with that?
I think so. It's not the first choice. There'll be extra costs, extra bureaucracy to get over, but we'll get over it. And so I'm not really worried about how the city will do whilst saying that it will be less good than the current arrangements.
Mm. So, Claire, obviously these arguments are being made, and there's Stephen Hester, who's in the middle of it. His sector, his company will have to decide what to do about the, how many, 13,000 people that you employ, Stephen? Is this the sort of attitude now that can be thrashed out in a civil way?
Well, but you see, listening to Frank, who has completely, you know, Frank is a Brexit pragmatist, there are lots and lots of questions and decisions that have to be made, and a sort of balanced view that we have to come to on all these Brexit bills. And ultimately, we have to go back to the country as parliamentarians and say, this is the deal that actually we think is the best deal on offer. I agree with Frank, this is not going to be solved in 2 years. But in 2 years, we will know the size of the divorce bill, and hopefully, we will have clarity on the grandfathering of EU's nationals' rights and reciprocity with UK nationals.
Well, we're told that will be a priority.
Absolutely.
And do you believe that?
Yes, I do. And so it should be. No. Absolutely.
Do you believe that will happen?
Yes.
Because you said it's not in our hands, it's in their hands.
I think it's absolutely urgent.
Yes.
I was amazed by the Labour Party wrong-footing itself on the last Brexit debate, of quite rightly being concerned about EU nationals here. But again, it looks as though, what about our nationals working abroad? And would you actually throw away bargaining cards on that? So I do think there's going to be huge pressure from both sides.
But at the moment, it's very difficult to have those debates in public, isn't it? As you read out John Major's comment. And this is why having Parliament involved, I thought we learnt a lot, actually, from the Article 50 debate. I think all of us advanced our knowledge, and actually ministers changed their position too. And this is why many of us fought very strongly for the so-called meaningful vote on the shape of the deal. Frankly, I think we will have many meaningful votes. Parliament is good at debating these things and getting involved in the process.
And the truth is, quite Caroline, apart from Claire, who was a noble exception, all the other people supporting these amendments were wreckers who actually still haven't reconciled themselves. You were quite clear, you've been clear tonight about that we are going to leave, it's the terms we get. But when you looked at all those signing and their lordship's house as well as ours.
The lordship's a different
Claire
deal.
Perry thinks not. She says they're not wreckers and they're not here to
Please don't say that.
That's the game of politics, to be a wrecker. That's what opposition is about, to try and wreck.
Yes,
not wrecking.
Well, now, we have been joined by Torquil Crichton, and you are going to give us a nice run-through of what's coming up in the week ahead. But starting off with Theresa May, who has said, or Number 10 has said, that she'll be doing a tour around the UK. And we understand she'll be heading to Cardiff or to Wales tomorrow.
The Prime Minister promised to tour all the countries of the United Kingdom ahead of triggering Article 50. Mm. She hasn't done that yet, remember? So she's in Wales tomorrow. But, of course, the big question is, where shall she go next?
Well, and where do you think she might? I mean, is there a mark in her diary against Scotland?
Well, there's certainly a mark in the diary in Scotland on Tuesday and Wednesday when the Scottish Parliament in Holyrood debate this two-day debate on whether to demand a referendum. It'll probably be carried by a majority. Will Theresa May ambush that the same way as Nicola Sturgeon ambushed her Article 50 plans last week? It seems like a guerrilla war or an air war going on between these two just now. So who knows? She might be in Scotland this week or soon, before she triggers Article 50 anyway. And, of course, she'll have to go to Northern Ireland as well, which is a far more complex situation than Scotland is.
Well, you've joined us having come from the SNP conference in Aberdeen. Has Stephen Gethins, the SNP's Europe spokesman.
So good evening.
Welcome to you. Very nice to talk to you. And as Torquil said, you're voting on a second independence referendum on Wednesday.
My colleagues in the Scottish Parliament are.
MSPs are.
Yeah.
And it would be extraordinary if they lost that vote, wouldn't it? But What happens then? So they secure the right to hold a referendum, but as long as Theresa May is saying you can't have it now, can you just press ahead with an advisory referendum?
This isn't what is being argued for, to be fair. What's being argued for is the right to hold the referendum. And critically, and I think this is quite important in terms of the debate, not now, but when the terms of the deal to leave the European Union are clear. And that's why the First Minister was quite clear in setting out a timetable of between sort of autumn 2018 and spring 2019, because by that stage, you'll need to know. So that's giving people a choice, but before it's too late.
She was suggesting that there might be a bit of wiggle room on that.
Yeah.
If, depending on when the Brexit talks look as if they're concluding. So
sure.
She would give a bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think something that's been characteristic of Nicola Sturgeon so far has been her willingness to compromise. So obviously there was a compromise document before Christmas looking at a pan-UK solution. And now you've got Nicola Sturgeon turning around and saying that she can compromise in terms of a date. Now, we've just had a series of no's from Theresa May, and for how long that is sustainable, I'm not entirely clear.
Well, she's saying not now, and her argument, of course, is do not hold a referendum until after we have completed Brexit, because otherwise, if you do have a referendum, how will the Scottish voters know what deal they're talking about? Because 18 months in, it won't be finished, will it?
Well,
we won't
that's,
left.
So the commissioner in charge of this process is Michel Barnier. And Michel Barnier has been very clear that he expects to see some kind of proposal from the UK government in the autumn of 2018.
But, I mean, these things could change, couldn't they? You know how these things go up to the last minute,
but in fairness,
don't they?
The people appear to know best. And actually, you talk about, you know, these things change. Well, the treaties are quite straightforward on this. And you've also got, once you put a deal in place, you need to then go off and give a say to the 27 member states and the European Parliament. So why in that process can't you give a say to the people of Scotland as well?
Just explain to me.
Sure, yeah.
Why are you so wedded to get a referendum before the door closes? Because I'd understand it if European leaders had held out the chance that maybe you could stay on as, you know, the remaining country when the rest of the UK leaves. But European leaders have been making it clear, haven't they, that Scotland wouldn't get fast-track treatment to rejoin the EU if it achieved independence after
I'm
Brexit.
I'm not sure they have. I mean, look, if you've seen the change from people like Verhofstadt and Juncker, who are leading on this for the European institutions, but also in countries like Germany, Ireland, France and elsewhere, there's been an openness towards Scotland. And the reason why it's so important are the number of jobs. Stephen was talking earlier on quite rightly about the job losses. In my own constituency, the University of St Andrews is the biggest employer, and we're looking at significant job losses as a direct result of lack of financing to universities. That's just one sector. This is an area where the Fraser Valander Institute believe that up to 80,000 jobs could be lost in Scotland
alone. But what are they saying to you? Well, have you heard privately something different, that they will help you out? Because the official word is that Scotland would have to queue up with everybody else to rejoin.
You talk about this word queue, and actually Turkey was a candidate, has been a candidate state since 1987, before half of the countries that are now. There is no queuing system in the European Union. I think that's very clear. Now, Scotland's a country that's met the acquis communautaire, it's met the rules. We're already a member of the European Union. It strikes me as one of the more straightforward cases that the European Union has on its books.
I think
at
you'd
the moment.
Have to square Spain, though, wouldn't you?
Well,
and
it was,
Belgium and Italy and Greece. And
well,
Cyprus,
do you know what, something
Slovakia.
On that? It was interesting that a member of the People's Party, the governing party, came out last week and said, look, Scotland's not like Catalonia, and that's really important. Also, Guy Verhofstadt, who's been very supportive of Scotland, was the Prime Minister of Belgium. You know, this is not somebody who's not aware of the sort of difficulties of that country. So things have changed, although to be fair to our European partners, I think they've been extraordinarily supportive, especially given that this is still an internal member state issue.
You were in Madrid a couple of weeks ago, weren't you,
yeah.
As your party's Europe spokesman, and you assured them then that the SNP has taken a neutral stance on Catalan independence. Why aren't you supporting their bid to secede, just as you want to from the rest of the UK?
Well, I think that's an issue for them, and somebody as me as a politician from over overseas coming and telling them what to do, I'm not sure it would go down terribly well for either side. So I think that it is wise for me to keep out of that particular debate.
So, Stephen, how do you see this playing out? Because at the moment, Theresa May is adamant you are not going to get your independence mm-hmm. referendum now, and certainly not before Brexit. So if the vote is won on Wednesday, yep. the right to hold it, mm-hmm. just answer me that then. Would you think that you could press ahead and just go for an advisory referendum? You know, just try out, test out public opinion, see what it's like.
I'd like to think that we're dealing with reasonable people here. Now, Ruth Davidson, who's the leader of the Scottish Conservatives, was already on record saying that the Prime Minister shouldn't stand in the way of an independence referendum if it came to it. So I think we're dealing with reasonable people. The First Minister has set out an agenda that takes into account the process for leaving the EU, but she's also open to negotiating. So I think Theresa May needs to openly and honestly conduct these negotiations in a spirit of compromise. I mean, let's not forget the situation we're in is that Scotland voted to remain. The First Minister offered a compromise that would have seen Scotland leave the EU but remain part of the single market. So there has to be a bit of give and take in any negotiation.
You haven't squared the public yet, though, have you? Because, I mean, opinion polls, they move around.
That's the whole point in having a referendum, isn't it? So that you sort of square public opinion.
Except
when we were told the only way to remain part of the European Union was to vote no.
What you're now suggesting is that people turn their back on the most successful union the world's seen between Scotland and the rest of the UK and join the EU with an oil price that has collapsed where your estimates of $7.5 billion of oil price revenue would now be $130 million.
Nobody's saying that at all.
So
now,
good luck making those arguments.
Ireland's already been told that it doesn't need to choose between the UK and the European Union. Now, if that's the case for Ireland, why shouldn't it be the case for Scotland? Do you know something? As somebody who chose to remain, I think that having that footprint, and there's an important relationship between Scotland and England, you know, and Scotland's an important export destination, a lot of jobs in England depend on that relationship, could be good for the rest of the United Kingdom.
And Stephen, the relationship with the UK, the trading relationship yeah. is important.
Of course it's important.
Do you want full membership of the EU or just
yes,
the single
full,
market?
No, full membership of the European Union. That's something that's it's been a strong party position for a long, long time. Full membership of the EU.
And Stephen Hester, let me ask you this at this point. Scotland here bidding to have a bespoke deal, full membership, but at least access to the single market. What about those calls for the City of London to have a bespoke deal? Do you think it's possible within these massive negotiations to sort out individual deals?
It seems to me it's very unlikely. And of course, if these matters weren't serious, there'd be a certain amusement one could get about people arguing that they want to be on their own but then want to be part of something and the other people arguing the opposite. There's lots of contradictions in here. But it seems to me that the economic challenge would be massive, even if you could do it. And you would have to turn yourself into a Singapore or perhaps into a Republic of Ireland, incredibly low tax, business-friendly, highly capitalistic, to in some way get over it. And of course, this is the opposite of the SNP's politics. So I think the whole thing is at the moment, a political game and not likely to happen.
A little response from you, Stephen.
Yeah, I'm afraid I disagree. Look, when we've got tens of thousands of jobs that will be lost, we have a responsibility to try and protect those jobs. The best way to do that is continue our relationship with our European partners. That does not mean turning our back on the rest of the UK. I'm sorry, Stephen, I'm afraid we disagree
on that.
And I think you've misread SNP policy as well.
And Frank Field, how do you view the call for another independence referendum in Scotland?
Well, I voted against devolution because I thought it would end up like this. I think we've now got to move, perhaps, if all goes well, to a federal state. But I think Mrs. May should just get tough and say, yes, you're going to have it this year. And I'm not prepared for Miss Sturgeon to keep playing around like this. We will actually let the voters in Scotland decide. That will end, I think, the First Minister's rule in Scotland. I think we'll put them to bed for quite a bit of time. I would roll it up with what I think will be a general election for us this year, in that we haven't mentioned, I thought the most serious, important piece of news in the last week was that 20 Tories have had their election accounts referred by their chief constables to the prosecuting authorities.
Well, we are going to get onto that in a minute,
right,
Frank.
So,
I
think, you know, this will be a really good time to give them their referendum. We know the arguments. They won't get the deal they were offered last time. And I think that will actually, sadly, put the SNP in the box for quite a long period of time.
Stephen Geffins, thank you very much for coming in. And I'm going to carry on talking now with Torquil, looking ahead. And yes, this point about the election funding row and how it's playing into talk maybe of a snap election. Just remind us what the row is about and how many Tory MPs are affected.
Well, it's a great journalistic story, great journalistic scoop that set a hair running about a possible May election. And it stems from the fact that a dozen police forces have handed files to the Crown Prosecution Service over allegations about 20 marginal seats that were won by the Tories during the last election. And there's a separate investigation by the Electoral Commission, which fined the Conservative Party £70,000 last week for breaching spending rules for local constituencies. It all centres around the battle bus and what GCHQ, Conservative Central Office, say was a national campaign that reached out into local areas. Mm. Nothing wrong with that, they say, all above board. More than £100,000 was spent on this battle bus, remembering targeting, going to these target seats. Now, the other party's been kind of silent about this because other parties run national campaigns.
Everyone does it. We have the Harry Harman pink bus. Yeah. We've had Lib Dems.
Well, Labour were dragged into the
helicopter.
Labour were dragged into the election spending scandal because I think there were a dozen battle bus visits not registered by local candidates for the Labour Party as well. So it's been an issue for the parties. But here with the Conservatives, it's that police forces have got involved, that there could be maybe 20 MPs questioned. Do you think there might be by-elections, Torquil?
There could be prosecutions and there could be criminal prosecutions, quite a serious matter, and there could be fines. And the Electoral Commission says they should have a lot more muscle to discourage the parties from doing this by fining them a lot more. Whether, you know, a trapdoor opens on the stage in the shape of a general election and everybody escapes down that from the Keystone Cops coming on stage left, I don't think so. I mean, it looks kind of unlikely. Why would Theresa May risk a general election?
I don't know. What do you think, Claire Perry?
I think that overall the party spent £2 million less than its overall national spending limit.
But that's not what this is about. No, but it's about the way that money was used locally.
The challenge of how you run a central campaign to support marginal seats is something that all parties deal with, and everyone piles into all the marginal seats. I go up to campaign in places and I frequently bump into all sorts of friends from the Houses of Parliament. I genuinely think this was a question of registering things in different boxes. Mm. The two things are linked because the police investigations are about, you know, local declarations.
But is a snap election the way out of it?
Absolutely
then
not. Theresa May is not Nicola Sturgeon. She is not going to do things that are all about her brand and about promotion of her politics. I think the snap election is not something that will happen. I do think the Electoral Commission's point about raising fines to discourage or to encourage parties to make sure the right numbers go in the right box, a bit like Jeremy Corbyn's tax returns, Frank, you know, where everybody makes mistakes, is probably the right thing to do.
Do you think we have to wait till 2020 for the next election?
No, well, look, my sense is we'll go earlier. But again, a bit like the SNP's referendum, what are we going to put in our manifesto? Trust us to deliver some sort of Brexit deal that you might like. I mean, to me, I think absolutely right to wait to get through the process and then go to the country.
We've seen the Prime Minister with her current majority giving way now on significant issues. The idea that she can govern when maybe some of her own MPs are dislodged by the courts and the by-elections have to be fought.
But that's never happened, Frank, has it? No-one's there. I mean, we had a Labour MP that was prosecuted.
No-one's ever thought
about
the law was going to be interpreted in this way. I actually do think it gives her the first chance of thinking up some good reasons for having an election and dealing with Scotland.
And is Labour ready?
Well,
Is Jeremy Corbyn ready?
We're clearly not going to be ready for a very long time, are we? To put it mildly.
Well, you mean not ready to win it? Ready to fight it, but not ready to win it?
We're not in any state, aren't we? That is the truth. about this coming election. That's the sadness of it.
All right.
That makes it tempting, doesn't it, from a government point of view. But on the other hand, this is a time, I mean, genuinely, this is a time for us to knuckle down, do this hard business, this mandate we've been given that's going to be very tough, and not distract the country.
But if your majority keeps disappearing, it's hopeless.
As a businessman, standing outside of this, what would you advise Theresa May to do? Grab the opportunity.
Well,
or
the
not?
First thing I'd say is I think from the point of view of most of the country, these are sort of footling political games one way or another, and we'd probably like to have less politics and get on with our lives. And also get on, in fact, with the continuity of negotiating Brexit, whether you wanted it to happen or not, but at least to make it happen. So I'm not sure that the electorate as a whole are gagging for another election. Anyway, it won't be under our control.
Torquil, just on that point, and then on to some of the other pressures that Theresa May is under.
Yeah, I've got to say, on my own straw poll of Aberdonians yesterday before I went to the conference, was pretty much what Stephen said there. You know, you ask them about a Scottish referendum, they look at their lives through a rear-view mirror and say, I answered that question a couple of years ago. Yes, but there's this big Brexit cliff coming up 2 years' time. And they say, no, I answered that question last year as well. Why did they just get on with it? So I don't think there's any public appetite for a Scottish referendum. That's shown in the polls. And I think with Brexit too and with the governance of the country in general, people want government to get on with and deliver the results, whatever they may be.
What about the other pressures for Theresa May? I mean, she and Philip Hammond gave in to pressure from backbenchers over the national insurance contribution rise. There's growing pressure now to change the government's mind on how to fund education. The end of the government consultation on the new national funding formula for schools is coming up this week. Do you see another rebellion there, another cave-in by the government?
Yeah, because this is parent power as well as backbench power. Every parent in England can look at the website, look at their local campaign or local newspaper and find out how much or how little money their local school is going to have by 2020. And that's despite the government pledging to put money in and has put money in, but for complicated reasons of national insurance contributions and pensions. It looks like schools aren't going to get a real increase in funding.
So you think there could be a U-turn on that, maybe?
Well, because at the same time there's...
Claire's saying no.
Well, at the same time there's pressure. Yeah. There's another wedge from the other side on grammar schools, which the government are pushing. But you've got this kind of a new Avengers of a cross-party alliance of Labour, Lib and some Tory backbenchers saying that they would oppose that.
So in 20 seconds, Claire, why not?
Well,
why won't they give in on this?
There is a fundamental unfairness in the school funding formula that exists right now that means money does not follow the pupils. Children who need more investment don't get the money. Children from disadvantaged backgrounds who don't have English as a first language. And this formula is not perfect, I accept, but this formula is a good step in the right direction to make the money follow the pupils and to support those children with particularly difficult educational needs.
Quick final question about ticket touts. It's an issue that the Commons Culture Committee is looking into this week.
Yeah, they're continuing investigation into these super touts. And we think of ticket touts standing outside selling soiled tickets. They don't. They get onto the website the second the ticket sales are released, and they use their bots, their computer programs, to scoop up all the tickets and then sell them on at vastly inflated prices. Our own paper, The Daily Record, has done a lot of work on this. The Culture Committee, to its credit, is looking after consumers and looking after young consumers, who said politicians were useless, huh? And they're taking evidence
like
this week.
Market, though, doesn't it?
With something to with watch for this week, then. So that's the Culture Committee. Torquil, thank you. We'll be looking at the headlines in a moment. But now let's hear about the housing market. In England, it's broken, that much the government admits, but fixing it's no easy matter. The Communities Secretary Sajid Javid unveiled a strategy last month to encourage more house building and make it easier for young people in particular to become homeowners. But new developments often provoke opposition, so how could they be made more appealing? Well, ministers are hoping specially designed garden towns might provide an answer. They'd be built to a high specification on 14 potential sites from Cornwall to Cumbria. And as Keith McDougall explains, it's not an entirely new idea.
Blocks of flats, not barracks, have been erected in pleasant surroundings in the middle of parks and gardens. The designers of these towns did not forget that shops are necessary and are much more convenient when placed close to the houses.
The newsreels of 70 years ago presented garden cities as pictures of idyllic living, and the urban utopia was strongly associated with the name of one social reformer in particular.
Ebenezer Howard, the pioneer of garden cities, built Letchworth with tree-lined roads and a town centre, and soon after it, Wellin, another planned town, also a complete community with factories, offices and every kind of public building.
Here, the great... To our left, you can just see the top of the old shredded wheat building. A little bit further up in Parkway is the site, you've still got the facade but the back's gone, of the first civic building, which was a theatre. That went up before anything else.
Tony Scotto of the Wellin Garden City Heritage Trust points out to me some of the features of his town still standing from its 1920s construction, features that convey some of the spirit of garden cities and some of the vision of Ebenezer Howard.
This town, which was put up by a private company, don't forget, with very little money, was built by some people who had social enterprise in their veins. So they wanted a place which was fit for a community. And it wasn't just a build some houses, stick some people in it and let them get on with it. And garden cities in particular are not just pretty places with nice looking houses and a few trees. There's a lot more to them than that.
Letchworth and Wellin, they in themselves were experiments in applying Howard's ideas.
Katie Locke of the Town and Country Planning Association is a garden cities specialist.
They were felt to be delivering perhaps a bit too slowly, but that model really evolved into the post-war Newtowns movement, as it was recognised that actually to get a scale and pace of delivery, government needed to be involved. So we then had the Newtowns programme, which delivered 32 Newtowns.
But there was a significant difference between the Newtowns and the garden cities. The post-war Newtowns, Stevenage, Crawley, Milton Keynes, were built at the behest and direction of central government, which set up large development corporations. That was some way removed from the spirit of the garden city pioneers. For them, the ownership, the control, and not least the finances of their communities were all supposed to stay local. Tony Scotto again.
Letchworth retained its independence from everybody and still is independent as a trust and has very considerable income based on its farm and its industrial properties and its retail properties.
Being run for the benefit of the community was a crucial principle of the early garden cities. That way they avoided some of the negative image problems that the new towns went on to suffer from, a reputation for characterless functionality and dull uniform housing. So is that why the current government is revisiting the garden brand, as it faces a shortage of some 200,000 new houses a year? I went to investigate one of the 14 proposed locations for new garden towns.
We're not sort of saying no building whatsoever. We're just very concerned at the scale, large-scale development going into across Greenbelt, which won't ever be recovered.
Parish Council Chairman Mark Orson is the leader of the long-running campaign to stop a large-scale development of 10,000 houses going ahead at the small village of Gilston on the Essex-Hertfordshire border. It's now been styled one of the new garden town developments.
We think that there must be options for looking at brownfield and other opportunities before we do this. I think it would be an absolute tragedy if good quality greenbelt, which this is, gets lost.
I'm Mary Parsons. I'm Group Director of Placemaking and Regeneration at Places for People. We're a developer and also a management organisation, so we're one of the largest landlords in the country.
Mary Parsons' company owns the Gilston site. She showed me her map depicting the village's future.
So we're saying we'd start here at the centre where there's the existing roundabout, start with a village there, and then gradually create a necklace of villages around the historic setting of Gilston Park. And then as we're working around, you can see here we're looking at the area for the schools, which would be in a parkland setting, you know, overlooking the green space beyond, but accessible with good public transport links working around that sort of central loop.
Back in Gilston, Mark Orson accepts that the developers may have honourable intentions, but he says the infrastructure needs go beyond shops and schools.
The hospital cannot continue. It's full up to overflowing now. And a new hospital needs to be built and put and up and running in good time. That has to happen now, not later.
Katie Locke of the Town and Country Planning Association admits it's crucial to get both local councils and local residents firmly on board with development plans, which isn't the case at Gilston. But she remains optimistic that the Garden City ideal can succeed again.
If you take those principles of the Garden City movement, so making sure you're capturing and sharing land values for the benefit of the community, and you combine that with the powerful delivery mechanisms of the post-war new towns, then actually you can get new Garden Cities for the 21st century, and that's what we think the government should be trying to achieve.
But at the end of the day, is this whole debate just about marketing? Is a new development more palatable to the public if it's labelled a garden town and not a large housing scheme? Mary Parsons.
It is about a quality of housing opportunity, and it is about putting in infrastructure and planning for the long term. And actually, if by calling an initiative a Garden Towns and Villages programme, it makes developers and local authorities focus on those really important things, then actually we might be able to reset the clock in terms of the quality of places we are going to be creating, and that's got to be a good thing.
There we are, that report from Keith McDougall, and Torquil is back with the headlines. What have you got for us?
Guardian wing there on the front page talking about that subject that's shadowed this programme and will overshadow politics for the rest of the time is devolution. Theresa May's beginning her tour in Wales tomorrow, and the Guardian have a line from Carwyn Jones saying that the Prime Minister has a tin ear on devolution. Now, ministers say that nationalists will be nationalists, but this is a Labour leader in Wales who is becoming increasingly nationalist against the centre. Westminster will replace the EU as the source of all evil for anyone who isn't in Westminster, and that's going to be a big danger in Brexit when it comes down the road.
We've spent a lot of time tonight talking about divisions and rows within the Conservative Party. Back on familiar ground for some with talk about divisions in the Labour Party in the Times.
Indeed, yeah. It's an inside story, Labour's deputy leader, Tom Watson, warning that there is a plot afoot, and we know there is, for the hard left to take over the Labour Party. This is on the back of the revelation, I think it was in the Observer today, off of this secret recording of John Lansman, the founder of Momentum, the hard left group that backs Jeremy Corbyn, that wants to keep Jeremy Corbyn or a hard left leader in place. They're talking about getting the Communication Workers Union, and more importantly, Unite, the biggest union, the biggest backer of Labour,
which is in the middle of a leadership race at the moment,
election, to affiliate to Momentum, to then get control of Labour's NEC and change the rules so that there will always be an opportunity for a hard left candidate to stand as leader. As you say, this comes against the background of a leadership contest within Unite itself. Len McCluskey has felt confident enough to put himself back up.
He's been challenged by Gerard Coyne, isn't he?
Yeah.
So, Frank Field, what do you make of this? You've got the Labour deputy leader, Tom Watson, warning hard left supporters of Jeremy Corbyn are plotting to take control of the party.
Well, it's hardly news, or hardly new news, because the party's been through this once again before with Militant. And I think the key worry is not that there are not many good people in Momentum who stand on the issues I stand on and have got a really committed view. But the nature of political parties is being changed by this process. Up to now, to this latest moves, political parties have been seen to be the bridge between the party leadership and the electorate in the country. It was a means by which views could flow. We're now getting political parties which are capturing a leadership and closing them off for what's going in the country. So they're, in a sense, they don't either know or they don't actually care what's going on. And I think that raises a huge question about political parties, their purpose, and how our democracy works.
Oh, so, my goodness, big questions with a minute to go, I'm afraid we'll have to...
I'll shut up.
That's all right, Torquil, just fill us in on a few more.
Back to the
we
Times.
We will go back to that at some point.
Yeah, wise words there, Frank. Back to the Times. The Times splash is about another initiative from Theresa May, this time to clamp down on firms that use self-employed workers and avoid paying them sickness, pension and holiday rights, for example. That, you know, cuts to the heart of what we call the gig economy, something George Osborne has just joined, I understand.
And one more quick one in 15 seconds.
Well, another quick one from any of the other papers is the Donald Trump story, which will dominate tomorrow, I think, they'll dominate the headlines tomorrow, Trump and his relationship with the security service and these claims about wiretapping, which go on and on.
Oh, my goodness, they go on and on.
But don't you think the story about Boris Johnson is going to be the calmer of all these situations? The idea that Boris would be able to calm the situation for Donald Trump is mind-boggling,
isn't it? Who knows? We will watch that. Well, look, that's all we have time for tonight. Thanks to all my guests, Torkel Crichton, Claire Perry, Frank Field and Stephen Hester. I'll be back same time next Sunday. For now, from all of us at the Westminster Hour, thanks for listening.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.